Hello, Alexander Reed Ross. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much.
Alexander Reed Ross teaches at Portland State. He's studied and written on the rise of the radical, or call them neo-fascist right, the alt-right in this country and internationally. We'll be discussing how to stop and re-marginalize the right that has grown from the margins to a very strong position in the Republican Party in recent years. Alexander Ross's best-known work is the book Against the Fascist Creep. That was published in 2017 by 221. It's no longer a creep. It's moving forward quite relentlessly, greatly aided by Trump, and that's especially concerning to those who know how the Nazis took power in Germany. Today, Alex Ross will discuss how they can be stopped and marginalized, what's been done here and abroad, and why it succeeded or failed. Alex, give us your views of how they have so spectacularly grown over the last 60 years and especially recently.
Well, there's been a lot of different kinds of tendencies that have risen up through different avenues, mostly through linking themselves to powerful figures and developing institutions that provide bridges between very radical and extremely violent subcultures on the one hand, and then the mainstream political and cultural discourse on the other. And then you have subcultural movements, fascist-aligned punk bands, Nazi skinhead bands, different kinds of cultural fashions and modes that arise and try to hitch onto mainstream currents and tendencies. And so they'll sort of glean followers like that. So a lot of the rise of fascism simply takes place in a kind of wolf in sheep's clothing type of way, trying to masquerade as more mainstream and draw people into the movement through various sort of initiations. And this is what the alt-right would call hiding your power level. So the idea is that you don't want to show everybody that you fully believe in the fascist idea. You want to gradually draw them into the idea by formulating all of the predicates in as clear a fashion as possible and convincing a fashion as possible without identifying them immediately with fascism. So eventually they simply wake up and realize that they're white nationalists rather than bringing them white nationalism an obvious package.
I guess in the current period, one could look at the demonization of immigrants. In fact, here and around the world, that's one of their major discourses that can lead to a kind of white nationalist, neo-fascist affiliations by people. Though, of course, they've been so successful, I think, and been written about, you've talked about it, how the great pressure and troubles of downwardly mobile Americans, many of them white, exurban, and rural people, also people in the cities, with precarious work and not seeing a future for themselves or their kids, with the internet sounding those alarms and the conspiracy theories, they're very easily attracted to this right-wing discourse. Instead of seeing their problems that were of a recomposing economy that's deeply disadvantaging them and dominated all the decisions, the rules of the game have been changed in the favor of the elite and wealthy because corporations sort of dominate politics now in a lot of ways that we can't go into. Tell us about how they appeal to too many working people.
I think that there's two lines here. On the one hand, you're absolutely right about the declining cultural hegemony of white adult males in the United States. This is especially felt in the suburbs. You have men who are pretty gainfully employed. They own stores or they work in construction, building trades, or what have you. And they see themselves as being less and less represented in the mainstream. And I'm talking about straight white males mostly. So they see commercials with representation of people who they don't identify with and that they have been rather prejudiced against. And it infuriates them and they want to reclaim a kind of a cultural capital, right? The wages of whiteness, as it were. And on the other hand, you have people with a lot of time on their hands. You know, if you look at Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and people like that, a lot of them have fairly successful businesses and operations and time surfing the internet to make connections with other people who are like them and spread conspiracy theories, listen to podcasts with Alex Jones and Steve Bannon and all that kind of stuff. And I think it really is this right-wing media echo chamber that infuriates people and gets them to hate their neighbors. But on the other side of things, of course, there are people who are alienated within the system of capital, and they're looking for alternatives. And this is where you tend to find the allure of a populist discourse. It doesn't matter if you're left or right, as long as you hate the establishment. And through these kinds of matrices, you do get people developing national socialist ideologies with the aid and support of the Republican Party, which has a radical faction that identifies it as a nationalist workers' party. So that's really where we start to see a kind of an amalgam taking place, an ideological national socialist position in the United States, which is quite dangerous.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KABU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, talking to Alexander Reed Ross, who wrote the book Against the Fascist Creep. We've been discussing how neo-fascism, not long ago on the margin of U.S. society and politics, has now grown to be a major force within the Republican Party, and they could well take power in upcoming years if the situation of working people and the alienated and marginalized people who think that their white culture in the golden days of white supremacy, that they've been left behind and are no longer at the center of the story. And, of course, if the situation of working people doesn't markedly improve. And that leads to the question of what might be done to drive the fascists back into the margins. What do you see as the key tasks of the left?
Well, I think fundamentally opposing fascism by all available means. You know, I think that counter-protesting fascist mobilizations is important. I also think that it's important to have no truck with fascists culturally, and to create a counterculture that excludes racism, sexism, and all forms of oppression. So I think that opposition to fascism is the main current. So it's important to keep that going and to, you know, create thriving spaces of discourse, dialogue, conversation, debate, active engagement in politics against fascism, not in contradistinction, but against. And one good way of responding to fascism is simply by taking up the progressive movement, by pushing the cause of unions, healthcare for everyone, and really making the U.S. and the rest of the world a safer and better place for everyone, so that fascists aren't able to draw in disaffected people who, like you say, feel alienated and left alone in the world. That's important stuff for policy. I think the first resurgence of fascism in 2015 was very much fueled by the rage against the systems that caused the financial crash and the fact that nobody was held accountable and the ensuing situation where the rich were getting richer and the poor were getting poorer. So the accumulation of capital was part and parcel to the reaction from the far right. And by opposing both the far right reaction and the systems that fuel it, I think that we can create a pragmatic and reasonable alternative with many different actors.
Yeah, one barrier, it seems to be a very important barrier to improving the prospects of all working people and making this a much more functional society in a lot of ways, is dealing with the climate crisis. The Green New Deal, of course, does try and deal with all of those crises, and it's worth fighting for, especially because many of the directions it takes really lead to a far more democratic society and democratic models that will be necessary in the new future. One great barrier to it is that the neo-fascist front recognizes that they have to create chaos and dysfunction and hamstring efforts at reform and non-reformist reform in order to delegitimate the government they want to replace. even through electoral means. They almost did it this last year, and if things continue to unravel in this country, which is quite possible, they could take power if the military and police really cooperate with them. That's really a problem. That's a terrible scenario. How do we deal, though, with their efforts to create chaos on the streets and political discussion and overall social policy?
Right. I think the primary motivator there is disinformation. You know, you have this street-level violence, of course, then you have a lot of problems with systemic racism within the police or within the economy. And one of the things that contributes to the violence is a toxic information system where you have stuff like, if you remember last year, the Antifa buses coming into your town, right? You have all of that stuff. You've got disinformation about the surge at the border is something that is unprecedented, all that kind of stuff. You know, it's actually complete lies, right? The current situation at the border is not particularly different from any year. During this time of year, you get a increased number of people coming across the border because the weather is better at this point. So, you know, all of the hysteria about it is just get people riled up. So the more we can combat that process whereby lies fuel hatred and anger, which fuels violence, the better off we'll be. And I think that just requires people constructing a tolerant public sphere where people can, you know, exchange ideas and thoughts, disagree with one another, have different opinions, and still be friends. But that process requires the exclusion of fascism because fascists are motivated by disinformation. So, you know, we really have to get at scientific consensus-based reality here. And, I mean, not everybody has to be a scientist, right? You don't have to get everything right. You don't have to have so-called right opinions about every single thing, right? But we do need to realize that you can't just make stuff up. I think that is one of the biggest things. And if you look at climate change, I mean, here's a perfect example. Everybody can talk about what we need to do about climate change. We can have different opinions. We can think different things. There are all kinds of legitimate positions to make here, but we all have to get off on the same foot that climate change is real and it's happening. But, you know, the far right doesn't want to do that. They want to actually say, no, it's not happening. And beyond that, they want to influence everybody else to say, well, maybe climate change isn't a real thing.
That might be their downfall, it seems to me, because when New Orleans and Miami disappear, that'll be a while, but some great storm could do it, or Long Island or many other coastal areas. It becomes clear when the storms are so immense, far greater than ever before, when people are dying, when their flora, fauna, and birds are no longer what they used to be, and food prices start spiking because of that. People are going to wake up, I think, and realize that the far right and the fossil fuel industry has done them a great disservice and shouldn't be listened to. That could be the end for them. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Alexander and Ross, who wrote the book Against Fascist Creep. Let's discuss one final issue. In some ways, it's distracted from many of the issues you brought up of changing consciousness and building forces. The issue is how we deal with the marches and gatherings and demonstrations, the recruitment efforts in colleges and high schools even, and, of course, the Internet. What do we do about the marches and demonstrations? How do we deal with them?
Well, like I said, a clear opposition is necessary. In some cases, it's extremely unsafe, and usually organizers responsible for opposition efforts have a pretty good understanding of when to not show up. And there are definitely times. At the same time, I don't think you can really just will away extremely violent fascists who are trying to march through the streets. I mean, these guys will absolutely beat and even kill innocent people who are not the right skin color, who don't fit their ideological point of view. So what do you do with this extremely volatile element that just wants to ride around and terrorize people? And that's something that society in general should not accept and should reject. However, that job can get done within like the constraints. Obviously, there are always limits, but you know, we always need to value the safety of society over people's pretend right to violate it. The Bill of Rights does not have an amendment that says you have the right to freedom of speech, you have the right to terrorize people. Like terrorizing people is not part of your constitutional rights.
Yeah, my concern often is that the fascists do their marches in order to provoke any kind of violence against them, and they get the police on their side protecting them, and of course the police will go at the left regardless of what happens, and they have agents provocateur in our ranks that look just like us. And it becomes not just an effort to stop the fascists, but when the police are there, they in fact get involved. A lot of the times they do. And then it becomes police versus us, with the fascists sitting back. That's a terrible dynamic. We have to be really careful about how we deal with the police and not antagonize, although they're antagonistic themselves. But reinforcing that could lead to a police affiliation with the right, which of course they're trying to do. They've infiltrated the police and the army. That's another major issue that we have to deal with.
You're right. And I've witnessed a lot of those observations personally. At the same time, we've also had incidents where extremely violent fascist groups show up. They're met by an anti-fascist side. The two sides fight. There's a lot of violence, and the fascist group ends up leaving. And according to their personal messages to one another, they left early. This happened last year. A group came to town, was looking for people to attack, actually was met with a counter-protest and violence ensued. Their plan had been to stay until the evening and to ambush people and attack them in the evening as well as during the day. And they left early, according to their personal messages, because they had effectively been fought back during the day. And, you know, I don't like to think about human society degenerating to this point, but it does appear to me, given the messages that I've read, that these people wanted to show up during the daytime to simply beat up anyone who opposed them, and then to run the streets at night, beating up anybody who they didn't like. And they were prevented from doing the second part because the first part didn't go as well as they had hoped. So it is a complicated situation, and I agree with you about people need to be careful, and this is not an ideal thing, right? The ideal thing is prevention of fascist mobilizations, not getting drawn out into the broad daylight with a bunch of fascists who have guns and knives. You know, that's, and shields. You know, it's what we don't want is full-scale street war with American fascism. I mean, that is hardly an opportune goal. But, you know, once it's gotten to that level, obviously the simpler preventative tactics have failed. So that in and of itself is already a failure. And I think if you wanted to ask me, like, ideally, what do we do here? You know, I would say ideally we create a culture that prevents fascist organizing from even starting off.
Right.
And to do that, you know, we have to be really firm about our commitments to the exclusion of violent and dangerous fascists.
I want to end this with a quote from you and Shane Burley, also in Portlander. It appeared in Truth Out. I read it recently. If activists want to reduce the potential for violence and deter further far-right demonstrations, it will require connecting as a true community, both in response to threats from the radical right and back in the neighborhoods, workplaces, and community centers they share. It seems to me that a large turnout of ordinary citizens to jeer at the fascists, who make life uncomfortable for them, it seems to me that we really have to ultimately build a strong, as you pointed out, anti-fascist culture of people who are ready to oppose them, whatever their efforts to organize. Alexander Reed Ross, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thanks for having me, Bill. It's been a pleasure.